This is Audible.
The Glitch, an Audible original. Written by Leanne Slade. Performed by Daisy Edgar-Jones and Sam Claflin. Chapter 1. Grace. Now. My whole life, I have firmly believed you should never have regrets. That each misstep, each poorly made decision, each soul-breaking hurt actually takes you exactly where you are supposed to be in life. That you learn, you grow, you become a bigger and better person for every single lived experience. This, however, this I really regret. And that's why I'm so sorry to tell you that the Lucky One is closing its doors for good tonight, I say. As of 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, this will all belong to the bank. I look earnestly into the eyes of my loyal staff, trying not to cry because I know I should be professional, but also hoping my face is showing how badly my heart is ripping in two at being forced to do this. Rhonda, my sous chef since day one, is expressionless. Patrick, my charming and beloved head waiter, is staring me down like he wants to cause me physical pain. Anika, my kitchen porter and the sweetest person I've ever known, looks on the verge of tears. Please tell me you're joking. Patrick casts a sideways glance at his young team. Teens in black aprons, their pens poised to write tonight's specials. I planned to announce this at closing so we could commiserate together and drink the bar dry. But when questions were raised about the barely stocked fridge, my packed up office, it all fell out of me in one sorrowful blurt. I wish I was, I say. Patrick's jaw tightens. But I have kids, Grace. A mortgage. How am I supposed to survive being laid off like this? I will write each and every one of you the best recommendation you could ask for. I'll call all my industry contacts and help you find something new. I'm trying to keep my words hopeful, but they're landing like live grenades. Cries of, "A warning would have been nice," ring in my ears. I know they're right. I should have given them some indication of how bad the Lucky One's finances were. Ironically, named after a winning horse I didn't bet on, which became one of the most pivotal moments of my life. This 4-year-old business has been an arduous uphill battle from day one. But somewhere in the last 6 months, I tripped, fell, and have been rolling downhill, hitting every boulder in my path. I thought keeping it secret until I found a solution was the best way to spare them any unnecessary stress. All those heavy entrepreneurial books I bought told me the best people in business know how to put on a brave face, to show poise and control. So I laughed at my team's jokes while holding red-stamped bills. I concealed visits from debt collectors as takeaway customers, putting empty containers in brown paper bags and handing them over while grimacing out the words, "You'll get your money." Pretty sure Patrick thought I was operating a drug ring. "How long have you known about this?" Rhonda asks. "A while," I say. "I've been in conversation with the bank, trying to get a bridging loan, something to tide us over until the busier summer period. I've done everything I can think of to turn this around, and I really thought it was going to be approved. But today I found out there's no more funding." "I've heard enough," Anika says from the back of the kitchen. She unties her apron and puts it on the counter. "I'm not sticking around for another shift if you're leaving us high and dry. Can you even cover the wages we're already owed? I have your tips from this week." I hand out the envelopes, gulping at their death stares. "You'll get the rest, as soon as possible." That's the final blow. I watch them leave one by one. "I'll make it up to you, I promise," I call to their backs. Rhonda is the last to go. 30 years my senior, this was supposed to be her last job before retirement. A soft-spoken gem of a woman who worked her way from fast food chains to Michelin-star restaurants. I've learned more from her than she has from me, and I felt like I'd won the lottery when she agreed to be my number two. Being her boss has been one of the best things I've ever done. I tell her this, and she nods with disappointed eyes. then motions to a cake box sitting on the stainless steel counter. We made you a birthday cake. Red velvet. Your favourite, she says. The door slams behind her, the gavel falling as the verdict comes in. Grace Monroe, guilty of yet another catastrophic mistake. And the sad truth? It's not even close to being the worst. I stand in the middle of the kitchen, the hum of the dishwasher the only sound. Half-peeled potatoes sit abandoned on a chopping board. A pea and mint soup simmers on the stove. There are a million and one things I need to do if I'm going to survive this last shift solo. Instead, I walk to the box on the counter. I open the lid, and it's like squeezing a lime over a gaping wound. In swirly icing, it reads, "Happy 30th birthday to our amazing boss." I don't even have time to cry, because through the gaps in the slatted partition, I see the first customers of the evening arrive, meandering at the podium out front. No Patrick to greet them. A woman in a designer coat is accompanied by what could be either her grown-up son or her very young lover. I see them arching their necks, looking for signs of life. And the overwhelm pierces my chest. I grip the counter, and the same pervasive thought returns. I wish I'd never started this business. Opening this restaurant at the age of 25 once felt like a giant middle finger to everyone who said I was too young, and that I didn't have enough experience. Now, I'm so humiliated, I want to bite that finger off and eat it along with my just desserts. The woman spots me and tries to grab my attention with an aggrieved wave. "Just a minute," I call. There's no way I can do this. I close my eyes and fill my lungs with air, bracing myself for the inevitable backlash I'm about to receive when I tell them there is no service tonight. That we're closed. Forever. She looks the type to give me an earful. Stretching to reach the top of my hand-carved oak wine rack, I grab one of the expensive dusty bottles. Then I grab a second and shove it in my handbag. Hopefully, it will be enough to soften the disappointment. Hers and mine. I don't bother cleaning much. Once someone new takes ownership, they'll gut everything I work so hard for and probably turn it into the 12th coffee shop in Winley Town Centre. I do, however, clear out the office safe and box up the usable leftover food ready for donation. By the time I've locked up for the last time, refusing to dwell on what a depressingly momentous occasion this is, I'm weighed down with a camping-sized rucksack and a cardboard box with my birthday cake balanced on top. It's a 5-minute walk to the train station, and it's as if the clouds have saved every drop of rain for the precise moment I step outside. How else would this perfect day end? The wispy bits of my blonde hair stick to my cheeks. Big, fat water droplets drip into my eyes. When my phone buzzes in my pocket, I only just manage to manoeuvre my hand to slide in an earphone and press answer in time. "Happy birthday Eve to you!" Sasha sings down the line. This makes me smile, which feels somewhat valiant given the last few hours. "Hey, Sash," I reply. I sound even more miserable than I feel.
"Well, that's not very chirpy. You have a stressful shift? Did Patrick drop someone's food in their lap again?"
Unlike the situation with my staff, for whom I was able to justify keeping shtum about the state of the restaurant, for not telling my best friend, I have little to no excuse. I see her every month. There have been plenty of opportunities to offload, to seek advice, to weep on her shoulder. But then I'd have had to confess how badly I screwed up my business and how little I still know about running a restaurant, while her law firm wins award after award and she graces the covers of industry magazines. No way am I going to tarnish the glow of her success with my failures. "Finished early tonight," I say. "So I'm on my way home to enjoy the last night of my 20s. The lie tightens my stomach muscles. I'm actually on my way home to stress eat red velvet, drink a bottle of wine, and sob over my horrendous life choices. It's as far away from enjoyment as one can get. "But don't worry, I'll be up bright and early for you tomorrow morning," I add. Silence. "About that," Sasha says tentatively. I instinctively know what's coming. I stop walking and realise how much water has seeped into my shoes. Please don't tell me you're cancelling my birthday tradition. When we lived together, before Sasha got serious with Roman and they moved to their fancy penthouse apartment, Sasha and I always spent my birthday morning together. Usually hungover, gorging on stale supermarket pastries. But as we matured, we branched out to eating poached eggs on toast with actual knives and forks in actual restaurants. Afterwards, we'd sit at home and watch my favourite film, The Holiday, even though it's January. I'm so sorry, she begins. Oh, Sasha, I say. There's a lump in my throat. I swallow it down. Is it sad that this was the only thing in my life that I was looking forward to? I feel awful. I know it's our thing, but Dr. Gomez had a last-minute cancellation. She doesn't need to explain. The best fertility doctor in the country, Sasha and Roman have been waiting for an appointment forever. With two failed attempts at IVF under their belt, I don't think either of them have the strength to go through the pain and disappointment more than three times. Dr. Gomez, with her higher-than-average success rate, is most likely their last opportunity. Say no more, I tell her. It's fine. You come first. Are you sure? She says. I mean, if I get back in time, I could... Of course I'm sure. Focus on you and Roman. I'm pretty much 30 now. A competent adult. I'll be fine. Another lie. Ugh. My phone vibrates again. Another call coming through. I groan when I see who it is. Look, I've got to go. Other line. Call me tomorrow, yeah? Let me know how you get on, if you're up to it. Sasha wishes me a happy birthday again, and I tell her I love her. Then switch the calls. Grace! It's my mum. The only person to start all phone calls by saying the person's name like they've slapped her in the face. You'd think she'd have a warmer way of greeting me, given we haven't spoken in over a year. Hi. I cross the busy road, heading for the dry safety of the train station. Now isn't a good time. She ignores this. I've been in Germany for the past week. I landed back this afternoon to discover Dotty has been admitted to hospital. A car alarm goes off next to me. Music blares from the pub that's far too busy for January, but it's nowhere near as loud as the warning sound going off in my head. My first thought is that she's got it wrong. That my grandmother would never, in a million years, list Mum as her next of kin. She'd put my name. My number. I'm the one who sits bedside, reading her to sleep in her assisted living home, the same way she did for me as a little kid. I'm the one who collects her heart medication and brings her meals three times a week so I know she's getting enough nutrients. I didn't even know the assisted living home had Mum's contact details. I check my notifications for missed calls, voicemails. Nothing. Hospital? No, I would know about it. I pick up pace, balancing the box on my hip, weaving between the shoppers and commuters and their sharp umbrellas. I'm telling you, it's true. I spoke to a nurse at the hospital 30 minutes ago. It dawns on me that I haven't made it to see Dotty this week. Or last. I've been so preoccupied with the restaurant, I haven't checked in. What if she's had a fall? Oh, God. My skin turns to ice. What if it's her heart? What's happened? I ask. Well, I'll know more when I get there. That's barely an answer. I'm almost running now, my chest tight, the cold air burning my lungs. Which hospital is she in? Winchester? Southampton? Basingstoke? I can be there in... No, Mum orders. Let me establish what's happening. Your father and I are almost there. I will call you when I know more. Trust Mum to treat something like this as a business transaction, to put next actionable steps on an emergency. I think of Dotty the last time I saw her. The tremble in her hands as she ate her gloopy pudding. The light in her blue eyes dull. Soft. The fighting spirit now a whimper. This doesn't feel good. Not at all. I make Mum promise to call me the second she knows what's happening. I tell her I'll jump in a taxi and head to the hospital immediately, and she sighs like I'm being overly dramatic. The caring, supportive gene must have skipped a generation, because Mum doesn't have it. When she hangs up, I slump against the station wall. Shoes squeak on wet tiles. The end of the day rush still in full swing. There is shoving, exasperated sighs, and grunts as people scramble to get through the barriers. I feel so dizzy, as if I'm a few shots of strong stuff down and life is blurring at the edges, reality slipping away. It's all too much. Heat floods my face, my throat closes. An image of Dottie being left alone in a hospital corridor slams into my mind. I feel the heat of a tear on my cold cheek as an announcer calls the imminent arrival of the 6:34 train to Winchester, and I force myself to join the wave-like crowd surging forward. With every step, two people fill the space behind me. There is no room for tears here. My limp cardboard box is moulding to the shape of the woman in front's back, the cake box lurching to one side. I reach the barrier. People push closer behind me, and I'm no longer sure if it's the rush or my emotions causing my lungs to constrict. I don't have time to think about it. My purse is in my coat pocket, and I pull out my travel card, which, of course, doesn't work. I swipe it once, then again, back and forth. Come on. Not now. Painful tears fill my vision. Every blink holding back a tsunami. One last try. The plastic flicks against the detector. Nope. Not having it. Oh, you fucking idiot. A tall man snarls behind me. That's it. That's what breaks me. The stress of the last 6 months hits me at once. In my ears, my eyes, my brain. I see the disappointment of my team, how badly I've let them down. I hear Sasha telling me my only birthday plans are cancelled. I feel my mother's cold, robotic voice telling me that the most important person in my life, the cloth I'm cut from, is helpless in a hospital without me. The sob that escapes me is violent, heaving. The tall man shudders at the sight of my runny nose. Do you have any idea what I'm going through? I shout. People look over and embarrassment creeps in. I lose my momentum. Be kind, I whisper with a sniffle. It has the same effect of telling a venomous snake to have mercy.
No one cares, he yells. Have your midlife crisis somewhere else.
He shoves me to one side. And because the world hates me, his travel card works first time. I cry even harder. People push by like I'm an inconvenience. Eventually, a lady in a high-vis jacket takes pity on me and swipes me through the barrier, and I compose myself enough to walk to the escalators. All I need to do is make it to the bottom and board the train. 50 meters maximum. As I step onto the escalator, I catch my reflection the moment a digital advertisement goes dark. I look hideous. Puffy cheeks, bloodshot eyes. My nose is as red as a glacé cherry. Jet black mascara covers my cheeks. A man at the bottom of the opposite escalator catches my attention. Tall, a dark coat. At first I think it's the man who called me an idiot, waiting for round two of Make a Total Stranger Cry. But then he turns. And I realise why he looks so familiar. He runs a gloved hand through his thick brown hair and steps onto the escalator. I gasp. Oh my God. Henry Dunn. I grip the edge of the box, searching for an escape. I'm already descending, but no one is walking. Excuse me, I plead, then again more desperately. That's when I notice the blockage. An older man with a supersized suitcase staring at his phone. I search behind me. I'm already a third of the way down the escalator and totally boxed in. Either I miraculously master the climb of a lifetime running up the moving stairs and over 10 angry commuters. I'm sure people have sought sponsorship for smaller feats. Or I slide down the handrail and fly past him in a blur and break a hip. Or my neck. Likely both. Neither action is guaranteed to spare me from seeing the man who showed me that real love feels like living in a Technicolor dream world, before he plunged me into darkness. As my heart goes into hyperdrive, I try hiding instead, shielding my face in the dandruff-coated collar of the man in front. my palm over my face so hard I can barely breathe. Of all the people to run into. Now. Here. When I look like this and feel as fragile as the flimsy cardboard in my hands. I divert my eyes to my feet. He spotted me. I know it. I feel him watching me. I know I shouldn't look too. I should play dumb. Oblivious. But it's Henry. And so I look up. And, like I knew they would, our eyes meet. Jade green, the colour of Aurora Borealis, the lucky clover that never found us. Henry's lips part with the smallest expression of shock. There are a few flecks of shiny silver around his ears, and he's grown out a neat beard. It hides his strong jaw, but looks so good I feel the flurries of something in the pit of my stomach. A level of handsome I never got over. We blink at the same time. There's a current of electricity zipping between us. In, out, all over. I feel it in every inch of me, from my vibrating fingertips to my pulsating chest. Grief, betrayal, love, and lust. All the emotions that were lost when we broke up are now rushing around in an endless loop. I know he's feeling it too. I can tell by the hurt in his eyes, the way his jaw works back and forth. My heart rises, every beat pushing it higher, further into the back of my throat. He's close enough to touch now. If I reached across the railing, I could have my hands on him, to know for sure that he's real, that it's happening. His eyes burn into me. It's the type of look that can pierce a moment in time. It follows you. He parts his lips to say something. I hold my breath. And then he's past me. Up, 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 up. Moving on, moving forward, without me. Just like 4 years ago. I reach the bottom of the escalator and stumble. When I finally allow myself to look back at the stairs, Henry's gone. Disappeared inside the station. I wonder if I imagined it. If I dreamed the whole thing. I'm snapped back to reality with a painful shoulder barge, then another. Stopping at the bottom of a busy escalator is a public transport crime punishable by death. Over the speaker, an announcement tells me that my train is departing, and as I make one last run for it, my box takes flight. Up, up, twisting, turning, somersaulting like a trapeze artist, but it fumbles the landing. Everything smashes onto the floor. The box rips in two. My 30th birthday cake hits the ground last, landing with a splat and crumbling to pieces as hundreds of people stomp the soft red sponge to mush. It's exactly how my heart feels. Chapter 2. Grace. Now. It's 55 minutes until I turn 30. I always thought when I reached this age, this milestone of adulthood, that I'd feel it. I'd be accomplished, mature. I would know how to conduct myself when faced with an emergency. Instead, I'm drinking alone. I've cracked open the bottle of vintage wine I took from the restaurant. One glass down, and I know getting drunk is another mistake I'll come to regret in the morning. As are the 12 increasingly aggressive voicemails I've left my mother begging for updates. I've called every emergency department on the South Coast, and not one of them can locate Dottie Monroe. I've called her assisted living home and spoken to the out-of-hours switchboard operator, who could tell me absolutely nothing of use because apparently the home manager has been skiing in the Alps for the past 2 weeks. Based on the disasters that happened when she went on honeymoon, the place is likely in administrative disarray. I sit in the dark, knees bouncing, nails chewed, a second glass of wine in front of me. I don't know what I'll do if something bad happens to Dottie, if I lose her. My relationship with my parents is somewhat complicated, in the sense that it barely exists. They started a business not long after I was born, a financial services company, which they pivoted into a comparison website when the dot-com boom happened. It never took off in the UK, but the European markets loved it, meaning they were abroad more often than not. Despite having an actual child, the business became their real baby, the centre of their universe. It was Dottie who raised me, picking me up from the school gates in her fluorescent trousers suits, fixing my scraped knee with a dollop of antiseptic and a dash of her homemade herbal ointment. She was the one who taught me about sex, who showed me how contraceptives worked. She bought 5 different sized bananas, especially. She consoled me when I had my first heartbreak, celebrated with me when I completed culinary school. My best friend, my confidant. I was never allowed to call her grandmother because she said the ambiguity made her feel younger, and I never minded that much anyway. The word grandmother didn't do justice to what that woman is to me. My everything. I finish the second glass of wine and call my mother again. No answer. I call Dad. It doesn't even ring. I know that anything more than 2 glasses of wine puts me at risk of getting more emotional. Last time I drank alone, I ended up stripping down to my underwear and screaming out power ballads into the wine bottle until I passed out, which is a little less funny story and a lot more, maybe you should talk to someone. Now I'm on the precipice of my 4th decade. 30. Bankrupt. Jobless. An irreparable relationship with my parents. A grandmother possibly fighting for her life. Single. Screw it. I pour glass 3 anyway. It's now 20 minutes to midnight, and the chances of my mother calling are slim to none. She's probably seen Dottie settled in hospital and headed home to bed. It wouldn't be the first time she's forgotten I exist. Still, I call her one last time, and as her voicemail recording plays out, I notice the red hue of my white kitchen, the glow of the moon shining through my window. It's bigger and redder than I've ever seen it. My tiny, overgrown back garden is lit like a Halloween scene. A memory from when I was about 10 fills my mind. Me and Dottie in her bungalow, the crystals on her windowsill lit in shades of maroon. A blood moon is very powerful, she told me as we looked into the night sky. The closing of a chapter. The beginning of change. I get an idea so ridiculous that I shake it away instantly. But then, in the quiet red glow of my kitchen, it keeps coming back. With every sip of wine, it gets stronger. The memory of those first few nights at Dottie's, when I was left there with a small suitcase, a school timetable, and a kiss goodbye. 5-year-old me hadn't yet learned that my parents' careers always came first. I didn't know that this was the beginning of a long tradition of being left with my grandmother for weeks at a time. Eventually, Dottie's little bungalow began to feel like my real home. But until then, I wanted my parents so badly, I would cry for hours. Dottie was always patient, always kind, always knew how to make me feel better. I was so little the first time we used her crystals that it's barely a memory, just a fuzzy onslaught of images. The 2 of us sitting on the bed, the crystals placed in a circle between us. We'd hold hands, and Dottie would tell me to make a wish, as hard as I could. And I would close my eyes and tense all my muscles, wishing for my parents to come back, until my face turned pink, through ravenous sobs, right until the moment I fell asleep. Sometimes Mom and Dad would be home the next day, and I'd look at my grandmother in awe at how she'd pulled off such a feat. Other times they'd stay away longer. A new opportunity, a deal to chase down, it was always something. And to compensate, Dottie would drag her bedding into the spare room and we'd have a sleepover with popcorn and cartoons, and she'd tell me that although I might not always get what I wish for, sometimes I'll get what I need instead. I can't remember ever crying myself to sleep after that. To this day, Dottie insists that magic is real, that ghosts walk among us, that the voices of our ancestors can be heard in the wind, that a lump of crystal can heal any ailment. And I always smile and tell her, well, of course, when I know full well that the power of suggestion and placebo is a far more likely culprit than any mystical power. So then why am I standing on a kitchen stool, reaching up to a top shelf, past the thick, heavy cookbooks, to the little pile of dusty crystals I'd almost forgotten I had? Dottie has always made a point of giving me a crystal when she can tell I'm feeling out of sorts. An amethyst when I was finding my first restaurant job tough, rose quartz when Henry and I broke up, a pointy orange one for the weeks after when I couldn't get out of bed or feed myself, when showering was optional. I'm embarrassed at how desperate I am, putting all the crystals in a circle, wondering if there's a specific order or colour coordination I should be following. I light a candle and place it in the middle. What now? I look around the room, my eyes settling on a framed black and white picture. Dottie and me standing in front of the Lucky One the day it opened. They used this picture in the local paper, which to this day Dottie claims she manifested, even though I know she hounded the news desk for 3 weeks straight until someone agreed to come and cover our launch. She says that she can make anything happen if you believe it enough. Her optimism is part of the reason I had the courage to open a restaurant at 25 in the first place. I know what I need to do. I pop the picture from the frame and unfold it, revealing what I've kept hidden from view for the last 4 years. Henry standing by my side. I've seen Dottie's proud face every day since, the smile line she never usually allows to be photographed on full display. But now I see Henry too, standing on the front step, his arms around my waist, his lips kissing my hair. I can still hear the reporter accidentally call him my husband, still feel the joy when Henry didn't make it awkward, because he simply smiled and said, someday. This is it, I remember thinking as the photographer clicked away. This is happiness. This is what it feels like to have everything you ever wanted. 2 short months after that picture was taken, everything would be different. The night we broke up, I told Henry I wished I had never met him. But as I placed the photo in the middle of the crystal circle, I know I'm not wishing for that anymore. I throw my head back as I gulp more wine, then close my eyes. I take a long, slow breath, squeeze all my muscles until they shake, and I wish. I want that feeling again, I plead with the air. The happiness, the joy. I want to be free of my mistakes, all the regret. For Dottie to be well and happy. For my colleagues to get the ending they deserve. I want everything that went wrong to disappear. The heartbreak, the anxiety, the doubt. Poof, gone, forever. I open one eye and look around the glowing red kitchen and nothing happens. I feel a bit stupid. I'm about to try again when my phone vibrates. It's a call from an unsaved number. I dive across the table to grab it and knock over my wine, accidentally cancelling the call. Dottie's crystals fly in every direction. The glass smashes, twinkling shards decorating the floor. Wine seeps into my socks. Seriously, I say to the ceiling. I'm about to call it back, thinking it might be someone at the hospital or Dottie's assisted living home, when a message comes through from Mum. Very tired. We'll call you in the morning. That's it? When I call her, she doesn't pick up. I groan with frustration before firing off a reply. How is Dottie? Where is she? When can I see her? Can you call me immediately? I'm sending another message with the word, please, hoping a little kindness will appeal to her detached personality, when another message pops up, from the number that just called me. Grace, it reads. It's taken me all evening to track down your new phone number. I know I'm likely the last person you want to hear from, but it's important that I talk to you. I'm going to call you again in a minute. Please pick up. Henry. I stare at the message for so long, I don't even notice that my hands are trembling. Did I cause this? With my wine and the crystals and the wishing? No, it's coincidence, surely. Henry's little profile picture shines like a beacon, and when I click on it, his face fills the screen. Dark hair, trendy sunglasses, somewhere hot. He's smiling like everything is right in the world, like he's exactly where he's supposed to be. Seeing Henry looking so happy stirs a confusing mix of emotions. Jealousy, gratitude, pride. How has he got my number? I changed it 2 weeks after we broke up and gave explicit instructions to my friends not to hand it to him if he asked, which, to his credit, I don't think he ever did. I'd taken such solace in the fact that he couldn't contact me. On email, phone, social media. It took the heartache out of knowing he hadn't. So why now? 4 years later. He had the chance to speak to me earlier today, and he said nothing. He only stared. Still, curiosity tugs at me. What could he possibly want to tell me? That he's sorry? That he's forgiven me? I've heard those words from him before, and it never changed a thing. Never repaired my broken heart. The second the clock turns midnight, Henry calls. Drenched in the glow of the blood-red moon, I watch it ring, thumb hovering between the green and red buttons. A green light to a second chance, a red light to the final ending. I'm working up the courage to press one when a warning pops up. Low battery. I run for my charger, which is crazy because I've already decided not to answer. Then I hurriedly uncoil it, which is so ludicrous because I'm not picking up this call. I push the charger into the socket. I press the switch, and as my finger darts for the green answer button, I feel a shooting pain through my arm. My vision becomes rough and blotchy. I must have hit the floor, because my back cracks against something hard, and I can smell my spilled wine, but I'm too disorientated to look. The sound of my painful moan is replaced by what I could swear is Dottie calling my name. Grace, sweetheart. Grace, she gently coos. But Grace isn't here right now. She's somewhere else. A cloudy, dreamlike state. I see myself as a child, walking up St. Catherine's Hill, wind in my hair, soft blades of grass between my fingertips. I watch myself learning to ride a bike in front of Dottie's bungalow, her letting go of the metal and clapping and cheering as I sail along the pavement. Then I'm standing in front of my entire school class, surrounded by laughter I'm not in on. I see my first kiss, a maths test marked fail, a kaleidoscope of memories stopping and starting, coming in and out of my vision with jagged edges. I see Henry on the escalator, moving towards me, and as his hand reaches out to touch mine, as he opens his mouth to tell me something, my dream jumps like a scratched disc, a wincing sound. We're no longer in the train station. I'm outside his house in the pouring rain. He's crying. I am too. In a flash, it's gone, and it's the night we met. A boisterous house party and us in the middle. An island of calm. I feel the warmth of his mouth against my skin. His fingers played across my ribs. He's telling me he loves me. So much he can barely stand it. Words I've never actually heard from him, so I know this isn't real. But still, I close my eyes and embrace this new place, the sweet possibility of what could have been. An alternate universe, another lifetime played back to me in rigid timestamps. Then, just like real life, it's gone. And I'm left with absolutely nothing. Chapter 3. Grace. Now. Morning brings with it crisp, fresh air. A breeze sweeps under my closed curtains, waking me gently. Jesus. My bedroom looks like it's been the victim of a crime. A violent one. Burglary or battery. I must have fallen asleep in the kitchen after too much wine and stumbled up here half asleep in the early hours. I've pulled most of my clothes from the wardrobe and piled them in the middle of the room. I brought a half-eaten snack of unbuttered toast and left it to go stale on my bedside table. I've also, seemingly, sprayed the cheap floral deodorant I never use into the air. The smell sits so heavy I can taste it. I've barely sat up when the bedroom door bursts open.
Happy birthday!
Sasha shouts, interrupted by the blood-curdling scream that comes straight from my lungs. I simultaneously throw and kick the duvet into the air, as if a cannonball of goose feathers would spare me from a home invasion. It lands on top of me, but not before it whacks the plate out of Sasha's hand, and a lonely croissant with a, now broken, candle in it falls to the carpet. I struggle for breath.
Sasha, what the hell are you doing here? You scared the life out of me.
She laughs as a balloon floats to the ceiling. Birthday? I notice that she's wearing pajamas, that her hair is in her pink silk bonnet. Oh God, did I call her? Did I tell her what a failure I am? That my life reached such a low point I was trying to fix everything with a weird crystal wishing ritual? That's the only reason I can think of for her driving here and staying the night. I'm never drinking alone again. Ever. Sasha picks up the pastry and blows on it, then takes a big bite.
No worries, there's a whole box of them downstairs. So, how are you feeling, old lady?
She perches on the end of my bed, and I'm so confused I'm starting to think I'm still dreaming. I pinch the bridge of my nose. Everything feels slightly wonky, like I've slept through an entire week. I thought I'd spilled the rest of the wine, but my head pounds as if I've sunk half a crate. I reach for my phone on the nightstand, but it's not there.
Looking for this? Sasha says as she hands it to me. You left it in the kitchen, which is a mess, by the way. I don't know what you were cooking last night, but whatever's in the bottom of the saucepan looks like vomit. Or diarrhea. Or like someone vomited diarrhea.
I open my mouth, but I'm a little speechless. It's not like Sasha, the woman voted by The Lawyer magazine as the one to watch to be this crass. Not anymore, anyway. I'll clean it, I say. I don't remember cooking. But that's the least of my worries right now. First, I need to find Dottie. She was rushed to hospital. The smile falls from Sasha's face, replaced with a worried brow.
Really?
Yeah. My mum was there, but useless as ever, and I...
Because she called about 20 minutes ago.
I answered it. She sounded fine.
She did?
Yeah. Sasha stands and begins folding the shameful pile of clothes in the middle of the floor.
I said you were still sleeping. She'll call again later.
Said she's got her book club at 10, and then a meeting with an aura cleanser. So, might be later.
Dottie hasn't been busy in years.
Unless you count watching ghost hunting shows while giving daggers to the folks in the communal room who can no longer hold in their wind. Maybe the hospital signed her off as okay, and encouraged her to stay active. Or maybe the new social calendar the assisted living centre was talking about has finally come into effect. But thank God she's okay. I climb out of bed and rifle through Sasha's folded pile for something to wear. I throw on a pair of jeans and a striped jumper I haven't seen in ages. She keeps tidying, idly putting the lids on my perfumes and shutting my open drawers. When we lived together, my messiness would make her skin crawl. I thought you had a hospital appointment this morning, I say. She gives me a blank look. Dr. Gomez, I say. There's no way something as monumental as this slipped her mind. Sasha turns to me, using both hands to tilt my head back, her thumbs prizing my eyes open as if she's scanning for signs of life.
Are you feeling okay? You made more sense that time we made special brownies.
She laughs, like all her worries have evaporated overnight. Maybe this is her way of letting me know she doesn't want to talk about it. That she and Roman have changed their minds. She's told me how expensive IVF is. How grueling the first two attempts were on her body. Was that a cry for help I missed? I want to push her on it, but her smile looks so earnest, so bright and full of life, that I hesitate. She came here for a reason. To escape. I need to give her that. Sorry, I'm not awake yet. I reassure her.
Lucky for you, I make coffee too, she says.
She moves to my bedroom door.
Oh, I've got to head off. Got a mental day at the office. But tonight, we go big.
Big? I say, rubbing my eyes. The only plans I want to make are with my sofa.
Wow. Is this what being in your 30s is like?
One late night and you're ruined for a week. Don't tell me you forgot.
No, I say, my conviction as absent as the brain cells I drank away last night. I got you a catering job for the new girl I work with, remember?
I haven't catered a private event in years. I would definitely recall agreeing to that. But then, my mind has been so preoccupied with the demise of the restaurant, anything is possible.
Remind me of the specifics?
Sasha rolls her eyes. Tonight, a few trays of food, £300.
300,
I say. I am in no position to turn that down.
Cash in hand?
Of course, Sasha says. And then we'll stay and have a few drinks. Celebrate your birthday.
Or we can drop off the food, head back home, and put on an old film,
I counter. We're not staying in watching The Holiday. Christmas films in January should be illegal. She sighs. I'm nothing if not a creature of habit.
You only turn 25 once. You have to make the most of it.
She ends with a little wink and a nudge. Oh, ha ha, I reply, without a hint of humour. I feel closer to 55 right now. Sasha weirdly decides to take a shower at mine. While she does, I check my phone. There's no late night outgoing call to Sasha. There's nothing from Henry either, which feels weird, until a familiar Henry-induced feeling stirs in my chest. Complete desolation. There's a reason I cut him out of my life after everything that happened. Because it hurt too much to even look at him. To see his name. To think about what I'd done, what he'd... No, I refuse to let my brain remember. Drunk me must have come to the same conclusion, because she's deleted every trace of him. Definitely for the best. Even if it means I'll never know what it was he wanted to tell me. Sasha comes out of the bathroom dressed in a sharp grey suit. Did she bring it with her? She's acting like she never moved out. Maybe she still feels like it's her place. I never did get a new roommate after she moved in with Roman. Didn't feel right. Felt even worse when I was forced to stop putting the electricity bill on my credit card. She says goodbye, leaving a vanilla perfume scent in her wake, telling me how excited she is for tonight. I grab one of the croissants she brought and eat it while I kick myself into gear. No more wallowing. No more moaning. Operation Get My Life in Order starts right now. And hey, things are already looking up. Sasha is here, Dottie is okay, and I've got a £300 catering opportunity. It's not enough to cover all that I still owe my staff, but it's a start. I hunt through the kitchen, looking for my daily planner. It has everything I need for catering. Recipes, shopping lists, profit margin calculations. Sasha was right. This place is an absolute mess. There are stacks of unwashed dishes in the sink, damp clothes sitting idle in the washing machine, a weird smell coming from the bin. I'm mortified she saw it in this state. I see the place through fresh eyes. Is this how bad things have really become for me? This is how you expect students and skint young adults to live, not self-sufficient grown women. After searching half the house for my planner and coming up short, I realise the last place I saw it was next to my ill-fated birthday cake on the Lucky One's kitchen counter. Bollocks. I check the time. Almost 8. It'll be tight to get there before the bank officially take ownership, but I think I can make it. I push through the train station barrier and onto Winley High Street. It's a cloudless sunny day, but the kind of January cold that makes my cheeks glow and my fingertips ache. I've walked this same stretch of road thousands of times since I opened the restaurant. I know I need to sidestep around William the greengrocer's obtrusively placed Willy Recommends sign, which lists only his phallic-shaped vegetable options. I know the bus stop is graffitied with a swear word that would make even potty-mouthed Dottie blush. I know there's a manhole cover that if you stand on it for long enough, you'll have your foot covered in rainwater. At least, that's what everyone pretends it is. Except, William's sign is missing. The bus stop looks brand new. The manhole cover is a concrete slab. I stop walking and look along the high street, checking I got off at the correct stop. At first glance, it looks the same as always. There's a pharmacy, a charity shop, an optician, a newsagent. But it's the spaces in between I can't process. The shiny posters for old movies. The newspaper front page admonishing a politician I'm pretty sure died months ago. A nervous zap shoots up my spine. The feeling I haven't been able to shake all morning returns. That something isn't quite right. Like I'm right place, but very wrong time. No. I'm having a funny 5 minutes, that's all. I'm hungover. Or coming down with a head cold. I put my hands on my knees and stare at the ground, desperately searching for my bearings. It's at this moment that one of William's promiscuous golden labs cocks his leg against me. I jump out of the way, narrowly missing a little foot shower.
Christ, William snarls, tugging the leash. Jeremiah, no. Trees, yes. Buildings, yes. People, no.
He looks at me.
Sorry, miss, he's a puppy. Not quite mastered what he can pee on yet.
William?
Hi,
he chirps brightly.
It's me.
Why is he looking at me as if I have a giant bogey on the end of my nose?
Grace.
Grace Monroe. His teeth appear under the bristles of his swirly grey moustache.
Oh, geez, I'm terrible with names.
Okay, this is weird. I've been bulk ordering root vegetables from him for years. Did he hear about the closure? Is this his way of showing how mad at me he is about the lost income? Plus, he and Patrick were friendly. He'd naturally take his side.
Listen, I guess Patrick told you about what happened with the lucky one, and I know it sounds awful, but I really did try and do everything I could think of to keep it going.
Lucky what? He says. And who's Patrick? I sigh. This is borderline rude now. I understand if you have a problem with me, but I thought we were friends, William.
I know me closing will affect your business too, but you never know. If they replace it with a trendy coffee shop, you might get more footfall from...
I raise my arm to my restaurant in the distance, and that's when I notice it. A greasy spoon cafe in the place the lucky one is supposed to be. The cafe whose lease I took over almost 5 years earlier. All sense of time evaporates before me. I swallow down rising vomit. I rub my clammy hands on my thighs. I blink a few times, praying the sky will finally stop spinning. People are hovering around me, faceless, with squeaky voices of concern. I can't focus on any of them because I'm muttering, "What year is it?" over and over again until the words form one incoherent stream.
"She's clearly not well," someone shouts. "She might be on drugs. Kids these days are always injecting things into their eyeballs," someone else says.
"You can't inject eyeballs, Philomena. Check her veins."
An elderly man who smells like garlic tries to roll up my sleeve and I let him.
"See, look, injection mark," he says.
"That's a freckle."
Philomena and Garlic Man prod at my arm some more while I stare, dazed, at a pigeon pecking a rotting kebab. William pops into view, waving in my face before guiding me gently to the bench under the bus stop. He speaks into his phone.
"Well, I don't know what to do with her. She said she knew me. Now she's staring at a pigeon."
"No, she's not a bird watcher."
"Yes, I'm sure.
Because for one, she don't have any binoculars. You know what, David? Forget I called. Thanks for your help."
As I sit, my stomach growls, and whatever bizarre state of shock I was in begins to lift. Hunger and a hangover are the culprits here. But instead of trying to explain that to William, who is stomping his feet while having a domestic with his husband, I decide to make a dash for it while his back is turned. I reach my restaurant. What was my restaurant? Ducking out of sight of the onlookers convinced I'm high. There's a close sign on the door. Inside, it looks exactly like it did the day the estate agent showed me around. Henry by my side. Wooden furniture, plastic tablecloths, the menu chalked on a blackboard that spans the entire length of the cafe. Maybe the bank got in quickly, and the new leaseholders reverted to its previous state. Maybe it was selected for one of those speedy makeover shows, the ones where they do the impossible and revamp an entire space in 12 hours. I sniff for fresh paint, but all I can smell is the intense aroma of chip fat. I touch the window to make sure it doesn't evaporate in front of me. Then I catch my reflection. The same dirty blonde hair and beachy waves hitting my shoulders. Blue eyes. But it's my skin I keep coming back to. Bright. Full. The bags under my eyes are almost non-existent. Me, but better. The best I've looked in years. Rejuvenated. My gravity-defying boobs are a clear giveaway something isn't right. But it isn't exactly wrong, either. I think of that little circle of crystals I made last night. A wish, a prayer, a manifestation. A something, that's for sure. Behind me, the high street has quietened. There's no William, no bystander I can accost with my craziness. I pull out my phone and call Sasha. She'll know what to do. "You've saved me from a meeting from hell, so thank you for that," she says. I hear doors opening. "What's up?" I start and stop a few times. There is no rational way to ask your best friend if you've woken up in the past, 5 years younger, with a perfect memory of what you're pretty sure is 5 years into the future. So instead, I ask something else. Something that clicked into place the second the call did. "Sasha, tonight, this party, who am I catering for exactly?" "Ali Saunders. She just moved here. She's invited half the firm to hers for drinks. I told you this," she says. "Please don't tell me you're backing out." "No," it's all I manage to say, the shock radiating under my skin. "No, I'm not backing out. No, this isn't happening. No, it can't be Ali. Because she moved here 5 years ago, and I'm pretty sure I am the last person on earth she would ask to cater her event." "Look," Sasha says, "the last few months have been tough. I know you're not yourself at the moment, but babe, you're really starting to freak me out." "I'm freaking myself out," I say. "I need to get back into my meeting. I know you said you were going to go all out with the food for tonight to try and use this as a chance to drum up some referrals, but maybe go easy, okay? A few light bites will be fine. Keep your stress levels down. It's your 25th birthday. Try and enjoy your day and I'll see you later." She hangs up, but I keep the phone to my ear, staring blankly at the empty cafe, at my confused reflection in the glass. It's your 25th birthday. The words swirl around my head. 25, not 30. This can't be real. Because if it was, that would mean my life has somehow become a skipping vinyl, the needle dragged back to the best part, the day I met Henry. Chapter 4. Grace. Now. On the train journey home, I stare out of the window in a trance, thinking of every single mistake I've made in the last 5 years.